This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Craig Parkinson, and this is the Two Shot Podcast. Pop the kettle on, and let's dive in. How the devil are you? Yes, we are back. And I'm back in my house. I'm very tired. I'm very tired. Why are you tired, Craig? What have you been doing? Today, I drove a 7.5 hour round trip. I can't tell you anything else, but you're going to find out. And you're going to find out in the final ever episode about what I was doing today. So speaking of that, let me tell you how it's going to play out over the next few weeks. So this week, we're back with another episode, and I'm going to reveal all in a few seconds. Then next week, we're going to have two episodes in 1 week. And I'm frantically trying to fill the last guest. I've nearly recorded everything. One of my guests has sadly had to drop out today. So I'm going to record another episode as soon as I can fill that space. And then the final ever episode will be going out on January the 1st. Let's get Christmas out of the way. No one's going to be listening to podcasts. You're going to be with the family. You're going to be with friends, with loved ones, eating, drinking, watching telly. Maybe, like me, Christmas morning, you'll be jumping in the sea and going for a swim. Or maybe not. Who knows? So that's how it's going to work. Does that sound all right? That sounds okay, yeah? Good. So, before we get to today's episode, thank you so much for all the lovely messages, really, and great response to the brilliant Neil Forsyth last week. What a character. Stories for days, just genuinely really good company. And that's what these last episodes are all about, spending time with great people. And keeping the ethos of the podcast is you getting to know somebody. And I think you really did. And you're going to get that this week because we welcome the incredible actor, Mr. Warren Brown. You're going to know Warren from so many things. You'll know him from Occupation. You'll know him from The Responder. He was fantastic in that. Recently, he's been on £10 Poms leading the show, which I believe he won a Best Actor award for. But you're going to know him from Luther with Idris Elba. He played an iconic role in that, and we do touch on that in this episode. So the other week, I jumped on a train and I went round to Warren's house, and he picked me up from the train station, and it was just lovely to see him. And we got the kettle on and we got down to it. So this is the beginning of the end of the Two Shot Podcast. And this week, it's Mr. Warren Brown. Enjoy. I'll see you at the end. So as we trundle towards the finish line of 6 years of conversation with the Two Shot Podcast. It's a privilege to sit down with a very lovely man. It's Mr. Warren Brown.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Is it morning? Is it afternoon?
Who knows, Warren? Great. Well, here we are. You've welcomed me into your home here, just outside of London. It's lovely to see you, mate.
Lovely to see you, mate.
How's things?
Things are all right. And I can't believe it, as you say, coming 6 years. I remember having conversations with you when you had just started.
Well, it's taken about five and a half to get you on.
I think I was away a lot. I think every time you had a space, I was out the country filming.
Yeah.
And then there was a minute, I think it might have been around the Corona Coaster time when you were like, oh, I've got space, and I was back at home. But I think like a lot of people was going through it a bit, and I'm like, this won't make for a good a good podcast.
No. And I think over the sort of 6 year period, you know, I was talking to you before we started rolling, the podcast game's changed so much, and people feel that they can talk a bit more now and they can be open, but they can also talk about the career. If I'm talking to actors, and you know, I've just been talking to a brilliant writer this morning, he was talking about the vulnerability that he felt about showing scripts to people. Even though he'd been writing since he was 13, it took him till quite a major event in his life to have the confidence to pass something over. So, yeah. You know, it does take time, even though, you know, we're friends outside of the podcast sphere, but still, when do you get to sit down, which is the whole reason why I started it in the first place, when do you get to sit down with one person one-on-one and sort of direct the conversation towards that other person? It doesn't really happen. You know what it's like on set as well, is you get the downtime, you get a 15-minute, 20-minute lighting change, and it's quite frivolous talk. It's integral to what you get, what's going on, because you don't get deep and meaningful chats on set, do you?
Well, I had a minute to like kind of getting ready to this, and you know, you do interviews for particular jobs, and you end up, you know, promoting shows that you're doing, and you do like the same interview over and over, and you're trying to find new ways to say the same shit
from the same questions.
Sound interesting, and I don't know. You always get nervous as well, going, right, you've got to sound this, and you've got to like put pressure on you to be something. And even this today, you're like, oh, I've, you know, this is one of my favorite podcasts, and I've listened to it, and it's been brilliant. And there's so many brilliant people come on and talk about stuff and talk about the industry and talk about the things that you go on. And I think certainly for us in our industry listening to it, and I know it's not only people in the business that's listened to it, to hear people also, you know, going through similar things or having similar, I guess, fears about the business and experiences, and then just going, well, listen, it's a sit down chat with a mate. There's not, you can't prepare anything because you don't know what you're going to talk about.
No, so exactly.
Just but, have a chat.
But even when I'm, and the amount of people that have spoken to, who I met just before we hit record, far outweighs friends who've been on this podcast.
Yeah.
But obviously, it started out there with Vicky because I didn't know what the fuck I was doing at all, and Vicky hadn't done a podcast before either, so we were both virgins to it. But it does really help because there were things that came out in that conversation, as with, you know, you look at Neil Morrissey, for instance, who I'd known for years, things that came out in that conversation that you didn't know. So that's a sort of nugget of gold from a friendship perspective, that you get to have a bit more time one-on-one with a friend, because usually it just doesn't happen like
that. I think it might also come down to stuff, and probably get into this, but kind of like getting into this kind of business by accident and in the past, or, you know, you think, oh, actually, am I over it? Am I not? Imposter syndrome and thinking like, oh, you shouldn't be doing this. And for years still saying, oh, I got into it by accident, or keep getting, you know, get asked how you got into it. And it was like, oh, it's by accident. But it's like, it's 20 years now. So you would hope that accident, I would hope that I've put the work in and you know what you're doing. And, I even remember, you know, coming to London for the first time. And
when was that?
Agents. When I moved down, I think in 2009, just kind of got to, you know, I'd been doing little bit of stuff in Manchester, bits of theatre, just started doing bits of TV. And I guess like everyone, when they start, you know, absolutely nothing at the start, and you're trying to learn about the business. You're trying to learn the craft. You're trying to learn the, how the business side of it works and where you want to get. And, you know, initially you're just saying, you've got to say yes to everything because you need the experience. But then as you start getting little bits of experience, you're like, right, well, I want to try and do this. And then you have to start looking, right, well, am I only doing work in Manchester? And I think I'd been coming down for auditions and had a few mates down here. And I was like, right, I'll just come down for, let's try 6 months and see what happens.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah, many years ago. Didn't go back, but I think you hear, don't you, that like if you don't last the 6 months, then right, it's not for you. But if you go over 6 months, it's got you. And then,
yeah, but you know, part of that isn't true, is it? Because you know, you hear people that just graft and graft for ages, and then all of a sudden they get that break at such a late age, even though they've been doing bits and bobs here and there.
Yeah. Still waiting for my break.
I think you'll get there. You'll be fine. But you touched upon Manchester and the Northwest there. So I think that's probably where we should start.
Yep.
In Warrington.
Yep.
Which obviously we have that connection because I lived in Warrington when I was young. Do you know?
Wait a minute.
I have.
Why have we not had this conversation?
I think we have had this conversation very briefly. We may have had a drink. I moved, my dad moved around with work, and we had to move to Warrington when I was 6 or 7.
Whereabouts?
I can't remember. I just remember Eileen Bilton. Remember I call Eileen Bilton
yeah.
your houses?
Yeah.
I just remember that. And we didn't live there very long. It was less than 3 years because my mum really didn't like it. So we moved back to Blackpool. That's the
answer. Okay.
I know. But I think when, certainly, we were talking before about sort of friends and family. And I think because my mum was there and my dad was at work and he was meeting new people at work and friends, and my mum didn't know anybody at all. So I think she felt quite isolated, especially with two young children there. So I think that was one of the main reasons back. But there, yeah, that's my Warrington connection.
Magic, yeah. Well, I grew up in Warrington. My both parents are from Manchester. And I think, well, I guess in kind of the late 70s, Warrington was, I think it was being built.
It was being built around
that time.
Yeah.
And, it was kind of like a spillover place. And if you go there now, it's either people from Manchester and Liverpool, because it's bang in the middle, that were moving, you know, starting their lives. And so my parents moved to Warrington, and yeah, I was born 19.
It's all right, we've all read Wikipedia, Warren. It's fine.
I can still play 35.
I'm 47 and proud, Warren. Just come on my train, it's fine.
So Warrington, that's where I grew up.
Is it just you and your mum and dad, Warren?
I've got a sister, younger sister, Natalie, and they're still up there. Loads of my friends who I grew up with don't go up as much as I'd like, although, well, the last few months I've actually been doing a couple of jobs in Liverpool and driving up, so that's been nice that I've been able to nip across. I say nice, actually, one of the phone calls as I was going up a few weeks back, just driving past Warrington on the way to Liverpool, and got a phone call, and my dad had been taken into hospital, and he's not been particularly well the last few years. He's in a home full time, and we went to the hospital, and initially they said he's not going to see the week out. So we were getting our head round that. It was going to be, it was his birthday at the end of the week,
right?
Could have gone all. He's all right. He's still here.
He's still with us.
The support from. Yeah, they told. We were obviously trying to get our head around that this might be it. And then, then the next thing, he's kind of still here a week later. Had his 68th birthday in the hospital. Still here a few weeks later. I think it's been like five, six weeks now, and he's pretty stable and looking like he's going to get out and go back to a home, not the home that he was in, but. Yeah, so that, how did I start that with saying it was nice? Not nice, but obviously I was able to be up there, and obviously working in Liverpool, able to nip back in two. But yeah, the first day, or I stayed at my mum's and was due in work the next day, and it was like, and they were right at the end of their schedule, so it's not like you can do pickups.
Yeah.
And it was literally the last scene I had on that. So he was stable-ish, and my mum and sister were like, listen, just if you need to go, just go and do it. So he's like, right, I'll go. And
it's a very
of all places, the last scene that we shot on this particular job was in a hospital.
Right.
And then got back, yeah, then was, like I said, had a couple of weeks where I was just staying at my mum's and in and out of the hospital every day, and then back on this other job.
But obviously up there trying to be as supportive as you can for...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's very tricky when big problems in our real life sort of bleed into our working life, because it's not, because it sounds heartless then that you can't just, well, I can't not go to work because I need to be, my priority would be with my family.
Yeah.
But it's not like you can put off that roofing job and say, look, I'm really sorry, something terrible's happened, and we have to pull out, or we have to rearrange for next week. There's so many other people that rely in. We're a tiny part of the machine that's making this television program or whatever it may be. So how do you deal with things like, how do you sort of compartmentalise that?
Still trying to figure that out, I think. It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because I know in the past you'd have mates and listen, this job, I love it, but to the detriment of many, many things in my personal life over the years. And, you know, people will say, oh, I'm getting married next year, can you come? And you're like, I can't. It's so difficult to plan. As you know, you can't plan next week. Anything can change. And, you know, so many people, certainly not in the industry, are like, well, I'm giving you a year's notice now. And you're like, I don't know what that looks like. And, you know,
it would be so much better if you gave me 2 weeks' notice.
Yeah. Just let me know. But that's what, you know, it's like holidays, isn't it? You have to book, but you just have to go when you've got the thing. And I've missed weddings, missed funerals, missed parties, missed things that I should have been at through this job. And it's hard, isn't it? Because
it is. But I think over the years, certainly once I've got into my 40s, I've learned the power of certainly saying no. Mm-hmm. To things, it is a positive way forward, because you know what it's like when we're in our 20s, we're eating it all. It's yes, please, because I want to learn, I need the knowledge, and also I want people to know what I can do, and I want to learn what's the name of that guy that works behind the camera there, what does he do, what's this? You are like a big kid.
Yeah.
But the more you're slightly, I mean, never totally stable, but the more stable that you are, to say no to things is important.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a slightly off, because as you say, I do remember first starting out and just going yes, and it doesn't matter what it is, and then the first time that you're actually able to go, oh, hang on, I'll have to think about this one, rather than just going yes and yeah, no is one of the only things that the power you've got is.
Yeah, absolutely.
The first time going, actually, no, I thought it was going to pan out like this, but actually I'd rather try and go down this route and it might be trickier, but actually then going, no, I don't want to do that. And, there is something, there's a power in actually.
Especially if you're being pushed into what you would conceive to be the safer option. And I'm talking about sort of work now, I'm talking about certain characters, because certainly if you've played a certain type that people would know you for, or you would be recognised, and I'm not just talking about people on the street, I'm talking about obviously people in the industry who would be casting things, or certain directors who would want you for things. If you feel that you've played that part once, or a version of it, to say no, and then, because the safest thing would be to go, yeah, well, I'll do it because it's work.
Yeah.
But the braver option would be to go, do you know what? I don't know what's behind door B at the moment.
Yeah.
But if I go through door A, how will I feel about myself?
Yeah, and that exact thing, and that was kind of a massive, I guess, a turning point, or as I said, you know, first starting off and just doing little bits and doing little bits, and then, you know, didn't go to drama school. And I kind of consider, I did a, we talk about work or you don't talk about work?
We talk about everything. We talk about everything now.
Yeah. I consider, like, I did 6 months on Hollyoaks, and that was my drama school, because that was the first time, you know, I'd done Shameless, I'd done a few little things, but that was every single day doing it. And I just, yeah, learned so much doing that, and then kind of left there. I remember I was actually at, this conversation is just going to pinball, but that's fine, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's how it should be.
I remember, didn't go to drama school. Well, I didn't get into drama school, and I remember I auditioned for Salford University for a performing arts degree. So I went there, and I thought, you know, kind of considered that, yes, it's not drama school, but it's at least doing something along those lines. And I did 2 years, and then the Hollyoaks job came up, and I remember, like, been doing acting classes and stuff like that outside of, because for me it was, you know, you're doing, and I was a bit older when I went, but it was like, you know, 3.5 days, and I guess so many people were like, oh, brilliant, 3.5 days a week at uni and then I'll be an actor. And it was like, well, no, but that gives you loads of time to get involved in theatre outside, get involved in acting classes, get off your back and do yeah. stuff. So I was doing quite a bit of, like, theatre outside in Manchester. And then, yeah, Hollyoaks, that was amazing. And I remember there was an acting class, and I remember someone going, oh, that's it, you've made it. And I'm like, no, I've got a job for 6 months. And
I mean, it's very dangerous. Just stay down. Just want to, we can carry on recording. I just want to check something that's on. Oh. Yeah, it's all right. I just want to make sure the lights are on, the lights.
It's all... It's,
yeah, it's so dangerous. To, I mean, not say that, I know you wouldn't be the type of person to say that, but to believe that, oh, you've made it. Whoa, and this is the stepping stone. This is the start of it. This is the training ground. I was talking the other week about rep theatre and how it's not there anymore, because that was such a training ground for so many actors starting out. But when I started out, certainly on telly, the sort of rep telly training ground was The Bill. It was Casualty, you know, it was Holby, it was Hollyoaks. Yep. So it's interesting that you say that you learned so much, because for those people not in the industry who are listening, let's say, what would you say a normal page count of a quote unquote normal television program would be? Six would be a lot. Yep. So do you remember what kind of page count you're looking at on Hollyoaks?
Like 15.
Yeah.
15, 20. It's silly, yeah.
So that shows you.
And you'd be shooting, like, you'd be shooting a few different episodes at once. And then they might be like, oh, something's changed. Here's an episode and we're shooting this today. So you actually have to, just be able to. And I think it helped with speed of stuff, because then, you know, later on doing drama, when you get to that, oh, it's only four. It was almost like, oh, this is, I don't want to say easy, Craig.
No.
It was, there was a preparation that I'd had before that enabled you to, whether that is learning your, oh God, how do you learn your lines?
I'm not Gordon Smart.
I was going to do that as well. Gordon Smart, who asked Daniel Day-Lewis, how do you learn your fucking lines? But yeah, kind of, I remember that going, that's it, you've made it. And you're like, you've never made, I mean, what even is made it? No. I'm doing a job for 6 months. And I remember going back to uni after that, because I wanted to finish this course.
What were you doing at uni?
Performing arts.
Right.
And I don't know, again, not that a performing arts degree will help you in this industry, but I guess I'd started it. No one really had.
And again, you just, there's more tools to put in your backpack. It's just about gaining the knowledge. The thing is, we never stop learning, do we?
No.
On any jobs. No. You take away a handful of things from every single job.
Yeah.
Whether that's, a relationship with somebody, and that can be in front or behind of the camera.
Yeah.
And it informs and helps you in every step of the way. I really believe that.
I think it was also just one of those things that I'd started it and I wanted to finish it. And, you know, no one in my family had been to uni. Not that performing arts is a proper degree, but I just had this thing that I wanted to finish it. And then I went back to finish the final year, got another job. So I left to do this other job. And then, yeah, the coming back to that kind of, I guess the first kind of no thing, there was a couple of jobs that I'd been in to see for that were going to be like regular. And I guess at this point you're just going, oh, well, I don't know. You just take what comes up and you don't really, it's difficult to plan that far ahead.
Yeah.
So there was two serial dramas that were potential, you know, they weren't at the offer stage, but I'd been in and it was like looking like that. And then I read a script and I remember reading this script, and this was the first time. And I guess at that point, you know, you're reading bits of that equate to your experience or what you've done, or, and this was a three-part drama. Would I have known who was in it at the point? I think I did. It was going to be Stephen Graham and Jimmy Nesbitt, and I read this script, and for the first time ever, because I've, you know, been reading whether, you know, the Hollyoaks stuff or, you know, just the little bits of little characters, but this was like, you know, a lead, and it was a, you know, brilliant script by Peter Bowker. And I remember reading it and absolutely bawling my eyes out. And it was like, it was a moment of going, wow, I didn't know that this...
Didn't know it was like this.
I didn't know it could be like this. Yeah. This was the first thing that I'd read, actually, that you go, fuck, that really did something to me. And I'm like, in bits here, what's going on? And I remember at that time just going, oh, well, if this can do this to me, then that's hopefully going to have, you know, a better effect on people that are watching this. Not that, you know, there's everything has a purpose. And I remember these other two jobs that was kind of still due to go back in. And I remember calling my agent at the time saying, I want to pull out of that. And I guess, you know, there was a minute because, you know, I didn't start acting or even have the idea till I was 25.
Right.
So at that point, a lot of my mates, you know, they've got their shit together. They've got their job. They've got a career. They're married and got a house. And I hadn't at this point. And you're thinking, right, well, if I just roll on to do this, then yes, I can be earning regularly. Whereas the, you know, dramas, that's not going to be as regular, but.
No, very much.
It was down to just going, well, I think the impact that this has had on me, that's more fulfilling. And I, you know, there's no right or wrong path. There's no, it's so hard, isn't it, to go, right, this is the path I want to go. But I just remember at that point going, right, I'm going to pull out of that. And at this point, I didn't even have this job. This was just, I'd not even been in for the meeting.
Yeah.
So I went in for the meeting, had a meeting, and then it kind of went quiet and you're like, oh God,
what have I done?
Should I have gone back in? And then I think it was like 6 weeks later or something, I went back in.
Wow.
And then it went quiet again. And then that came off and I got that job.
Yeah.
I think that was like a...
I think that was a real turning point, wasn't
it? I think
it?
So, yeah, yeah. And then that show came out, that won a BAFTA. And then off the back of that, I guess the first kind of meeting that I'd had off the back of that was for Luther. And then, had a meeting, thought, right, oh, that's gone well. They might ask me to come back in. And I remember both the director and producer had said, oh, we've just seen Occupation, which was this job that I'd just done. And it was almost like, I don't know whether that was at least I'd done something then to prove yourself, or that was like, oh, you've done whatever. Because then a week later, when I thought, oh, we're going to go back in, it was like, no, they want to offer you the part. And I'm like, oh shit, right. Oh.
Wow. Okay. Isn't it interesting that you look at that first script that really touched you and did something to you, affected you emotionally, and you had to wait all that time.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, you're in one audition, 1 week, it's job offer.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen like that at all, does it, all the time?
No, you know, that was that particular job. It doesn't mean now that, oh, right, everything now you hear a week on, because it's all relative, isn't it? And now you
absolutely
kind of pushing on, and then there are still things that you go, oh, this, I really like this, or, you know, or it goes quiet and you don't hear. But yeah, then I think it was just round about that time, I had just moved to London, kind of changed agents after occupation.
How did you feel about, because I do want to come on to Luther later on, that's quite a specific point actually, but how did you feel about leaving the Northwest and coming to London? Were you told, this is where you should be, or did you just feel a natural pull?
Just was like a natural thing. Like I said, started, you know, done a few acting classes in Manchester. That's where I started off. Did a load of theatre in Manchester, like pub theatre, anything to get experience. And
which, you know, I suppose that was kind of quite rep as well for you.
Yeah, yeah. I remember there was a point kind of alongside uni, you were doing shows in uni, then there was a particular show at uni that one of the tutors was doing outside of uni in a festival. But then there was a period when like going to acting classes and you're meeting people at acting classes and like-minded and they're, I've written this and we're doing a thing. And I remember like doing almost like not rep, but it was rep. Cause I remember there was a particular point where I was doing like three plays, or I was doing a play rehearsing for another play and did like three in quick succession.
That's great training.
Yeah. But I guess even then, you know, you don't really know what you do. I mean, I know what I'm doing? I don't know.
No, I don't. Do you think we ever know what we're completely, wholeheartedly know exactly what we're doing?
I hope not.
I don't think so. I hope not as well. Yeah, I think if we get to that point, might as well just stop.
Yeah, yeah. I remember like one of the first bits of theatre I was doing, kind of waking up in the morning and going, right, it's tonight. And everything, I guess everything, at the time I wouldn't have known this, and years down the line you look back and go, oh, and I just remember it was like waking up, except when I used to fight before acting, and it was like the same kind of feeling, and then getting to the theatre and getting to the stadium or the wherever you're fighting, that was the same. Then the audience coming in, the crowd coming in, and then, you know, even the buzz after fighting, that was the same as like coming off stage. I remember there was a minute, like, right, we're going to do a warm up. And I remember we did a show at the Comedy Store in Manchester. And I've heard warm up and I'm in the corner shadow boxing. Like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm warming up. That's what I knew as a warm up. Yeah. So there were quite a few similarities. And I wondered, you know, I'd often, and I guess even still, you go, oh, should I have gone to drama school? Should I have done this? And, I've kind of, no, everything happens as it's supposed to happen, and everyone's different and everyone's path's different. And what I didn't have going to drama school, I had, you know, having a professional fighting career for 10 years and traveling around the world. And
we haven't even got there yet.
No, Warren, we haven't. I told got you there. It was going to be a pinball.
What I wanted to. But before that, can we just jump back to school life? Because I'm interested in where the possibility for you of acting came from.
Yeah.
How was school life?
School was all right. I look back in hindsight. I remember in junior school doing a couple of school plays, and for some reason always getting lead parts, but you know, never in a million years do you think of it as a job. And then going off to high school, went to a couple of different high schools. Our first high school shut down. It's quite a rough high school. And then we all went to another school. And I remember, and obviously I've got mates from both schools now still, but yeah, there was a moment when our high school was people went off to different schools, and a large majority of our year then went off to this other school. And it was like, oh, the rough kids are coming to our school. They're going to ruin our school. But yeah, school was all right. And I think, you know, looking back and going, right, where the possibilities and how did you get into it? And it's only much later that you look back. And I think I was what you would call a late developer. And I was really small for my age until I was like in early 20s probably. So I guess, you know, when trying to navigate school, you're either tough or funny, and I guess I was funny. So it was kind of, is it a defense mechanism? So welcome to my therapy session.
I mean, I certainly used it as a defense
mechanism. Yeah, and throughout school, again, I'm jumping, I guess yeah, it was often like, oh yeah, he can do his work, but he's quite distracting to other people.
Loves a chat.
Which I've actually heard loads on this podcast. It's like similar, a lot of people, and again, you go, oh, great, great.
Good, we're all in the same.
And I think, you know, that was, just kind of entertaining. And even, again, looking back now, going on remember going away with our family on holidays, and there was always about seven, you know, different couples and their kids. And I remember always just being a clown and always like imitating people or like taking the mic or pretending to be the guy, the Spanish guy, doing the pedlos and making all the adults laugh. And again, you don't see it at the time, but you're like, oh, they're laughing at this. Oh, this is so kind of enjoying that. And I guess that's something that, yeah, throughout school, throughout even work, when I've had a load of proper jobs, but at a particular job in an office where, you know, we were on the phones and it was like super mixed age group. I might have been one of the youngest there, probably. Yeah. But even getting off the phone and then doing impersonations of the people that everyone in the office knew and making everyone in the office laugh. But again, still, it was never, never a thought at that point.
Do you think there was a case of wanting to please at that age, even though we couldn't really sit down and think, this is what I'm going to do, I'm going to people please, but that's what you were doing because you were already getting an audience, you were getting a bit
I guess feedback. So yeah, whether you know it at the time, yeah,
making, I don't think
even as a kid making adults laugh, there's something there, you're not able to process it, I guess, but yeah, there's something there. And
I think there's a certain there's a bit of power there about taking a bit of power back,
yeah,
because we're making the elders laugh.
Yeah.
And we're the ones that are supposed to listen, but now it's the elders that are listening to us. There's something quite powerful about that.
And then, you know, even from having the idea of going, right, this is now something I want to pursue, and looking back again, and it keeps coming back to like the Thai boxing, but that was a performance in a way. You know, you put in the work, you get to the place that you're fighting at, and again, I fought all over the world, but that it was essentially a stage, and there was a crowd and people were there.
Yeah. So how did we get there? Because you mentioned before about being at school, bit saying, well, you could either be the tough one, the one that would fight, and that's school life, or you could be the funny one, you could be the one that was the distracting one.
Yeah.
How did you get into being the fighting one?
How did that happen? Everything's by accident. It was...
All the best things.
Going through school, done a little bit of a couple of school plays that were nothing. I did one play in sixth form.
Yeah.
But around about the time, I think it was 15, my best mate from back home, he was into jiu-jitsu. Excuse me. And they had just started in the same place that he trained a Thai boxing class. And he just said to me one day, I'm going to start this Thai boxing. Do you want to come?
So, and you'd never done anything like that before?
I'd done a little bit of karate when I was super young, but didn't for a few years, and then nothing kind of came of that. And then I guess I'd played all sorts of sports at school, but was not particularly great. You know, I'd had a go and played for the school teams or whatever in the old school, because that was the rough school. It was super small, so you could get on the teams there. But then when we moved schools, wasn't on any of the, I don't think, just hadn't really found that thing that you love, and then either whether you've got a natural ability, but then that you go, all right, this is what I want to do. And I remember going to Thai boxing and something just kind of clicking quite quick. And being like, this is something new, something different, but something just sparked, I guess, inside.
But you didn't feel intimidated going in there for the first time?
No, I don't think I did. And it turned out I was all right at it at the start, and then that became a passion, and I guess then you put everything into it, and then kind of slowly but surely, then you start after a year, you know, competing and.
Were you told at a certain point you've got a natural ability for this? Or did you feel you had a natural ability? Or was it something that you had to work very hard at?
You're certainly encouraged by the coaches and stuff, but I guess just knowing, oh, I'm quite good at this. And obviously I was, would have been like the smallest in the gym of the adults fighting. So you kind of holding your own with like much bigger fighters. Remember even like sort of, yeah, started at 15, 16, started fighting 16, 17, 18, still being like tiny, but you know, you'd have all sorts of like doormen and stuff in the gym and battering doormen when you're like tiny, just because you like faster. And obviously if they get older, you've had it, but in this kind of discipline of fighting. And then I guess it was just, yeah, starting to compete and winning and then starting to win titles that you go, oh, actually, yeah, I'm kind of all right.
Did you enjoy it as a discipline, as a focus?
Absolutely,
not just for your body, but also for your mind?
Absolutely. And I guess, you know, these conversations weren't around, I guess, at that point. Whether I knew at that point, yeah, the training and the discipline were good for your mental health, probably wouldn't have known that, but... At that time,
sorry to interrupt. I don't think mental health was spoken about at all, was it?
At all, no. But for me, it was just something that was, yes, you had the discipline. It was super fit. So you feel good mentally and physically.
Yeah.
And then just, I guess, you know, fighting and then starting to win and get to a particular level.
Do you remember the first professional fight you had?
I do.
Talk me through being backstage, walking through the audience. Tell me if I'm wrong about this, but obviously I'm just thinking about all the boxing films I've ever
seen.
Backstage, you're getting wrapped up, you're ready to go in, you walk through, you hear the roar of the crowd, the heat changes, your body changes, your temperature changes.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't know, your heart rate must be going up. How do you keep yourself grounded knowing that you've got to get in that ring and do what you've got to do?
I remember it. I remember all the fights, but I particularly remember the first one because I think at 16 and being super small for my age, it was like quite hard to actually get fights because I was probably the weight of a 12-year-old.
Right.
But I had to fight 16-year-old. And this particular fight, I remember going, it was in... a place called the Springfield Hotel in North Wales. And there was a lad from round that way, but he was like 7 kilos heavier and he was like 16, 17. But it was the only way I was going to get a fight was to fight someone who was heavier.
Yeah.
And I remember, going out there.
And hopefully show what you were capable of.
Yeah. And winning that fight and then just... The feeling afterwards was like nothing else I'd ever experienced.
What is that feeling afterwards? I know you. You're a lovely guy, and you wouldn't really want to hurt. You wouldn't want to hurt anybody. But knowing what you've done, I mean, was this a knockout or
this was just on points?
Just on points. But still, you've hurt somebody.
Well, yeah, and he was a lot heavier, like. Kind of further down the line, you would never give away that. That's like a ridiculous amount of weight to give away. But just at that point that it was difficult to get fights until I started growing a little bit later on. But I think it's just down, you know, that's what you train for. And then I guess by that point started to dedicate my life to. That just what you just put that together in the ring and,
So emotionally, you don't feel any sort of connection to your opponent at all. Would that be part of the mental training?
I mean, in an ideal world, yeah. I'd obviously at the beginning, I guess you don't. But again, everyone's different. You see that with kind of combat sports now. You know, some people are super chilled. Some people like to get in the heads of their opponents and act up and you know, it's ultimately a fight, but you know, even now, you know, combat sports is huge now, and to people that are not fans, just think it's fighting. Whereas, you know, the way I would look at kind of Thai boxing then, it's like chess, but violent chess.
It's violent chess.
You can't just go out there and I've seen it and probably suffered it myself of sometimes when you let your emotions get the better of you and you're like, right, come on. Or you'd see people like in the changing room before screaming and it's like, no, you've got to really keep your head about you and be relaxed. And
And were you always of that mindset throughout all the career, all the fights?
For the most part. And then, you know, throughout that journey, there'll be certain fighters that then there is something personal or there's something going, and then that's like a rivalry or whatever. And then it's difficult, different. But
is it difficult to sort of rise to that when you're with an opponent that's sort of jeering and getting in your face? Does that make it easier for you to stay grounded and calm?
I remember kind of throughout that fighting career that I got thrown in at the deep end quite a lot. And like, I remember there was a particular fight and there was a guy called Leroy Atkinson who, when I first started at like 15, 16, 17, I'd watch him fight. He was from Manchester and he was amazing. He was, you know, he was a bloke and he was one of my idols when I first started the sport. And then fast forward a few years and then I get a phone call and it's like, right, you've got a fight against him.
No.
And it was like, shit, I'm fighting like someone that I used to, well, I did idolise,
yeah.
Did, but obviously now it's like, right, I've got to go and fight this person.
So do you have to put what you feel and felt about that fighter to one side?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. Because, you know, you're going to get in the ring and ultimately he's going to try and kill you. Well, not kill you,
no,
but try and do you serious damage.
Yeah.
You've got to, you know... And that was often the case, you know, fights that it's like, oh, shit, this is going to be like, you got really up for it. It was a couple of occasions, you know, I lost a few fights and a few of those losses were opponents that I guess in my head was like, oh, this is easy. This, and you don't get up for it. And you're
right.
And it might have been the opposite way around for them going, oh, I'm fighting such and such. And, you know, a couple of fights that I went into not out of my depth or me thinking not. That I wasn't, you know, in at the deep end. So underestimate someone and you don't get up for it because you think, oh, this is going to be easy. And then you come unstuck yourself.
Well, I suppose you can take that into acting as well.
Definitely.
Because if you have a slope into a job thinking, oh, it's going to be walk in the park, I don't need to. And we've worked with them, we see them all the time. They come on, they're not prepared. They haven't learned the lines. You've got a few rules, turn up on time, know your lines, don't be a cunt.
I'll let you say that.
That's all right, it's not my words, that's the words of the great Kathy Burke, which I think we can all agree.
That discipline, and again, you know, years later when I was having this crazy idea that I wanted to pursue that, and then at times thinking, oh, I've not got the tools, or I haven't done this, or I've not done that, I kind of, again, look back and go, the discipline and the commitment that I had for, you know, finding something that you love doing and going, right, everything gets poured into it, every fibre of your being. And so committed, worked so hard to get to the level that I got to. And I guess I was able to, you know, when I stopped fighting to pursue acting. And often you hear, you know, it was professional, but it wasn't, you know, it's a lot bigger now. But it was certainly not big enough to be making a substantial living. So you'd be getting a few quid, but not enough. You know, we were still working. So you were also trying to, you know, work a day job, train of an evening, or train in the morning, go to work, train of an evening.
So you probably have no social life to speak of during then if you were sort of trying.
That became my life. And that was, I guess, how... You know, you only get into something what you put out, right?
Yeah.
And I put everything into it, and that was my life. You know, anytime we were, you know, training of a weekend.
And so did you make a conscious decision to end that part of your life and that part of that career to move forward?
Yeah, and, you know, there was a bit of a crossover. So started training in Warrington, and then... A few years down the line, a few of our fighters left to go and train at another gym in Manchester. And we'd train, and then on a Friday night after training, we'd go to a sauna at a leisure centre near the gym. And there was a load of dudes in this sauna that we got chatting to. It's not going to go down that way. I don't know where you're going.
It's my listening face, Warren. Right,
okay. And we just got all the fellas in this sauna we'd see every week when we'd go after training. And from all walks of life, and we'd have a crack with them. And there was one particular fella who was pretty much like a professional extra, did like background work.
Yeah.
And I was chatting to him about that. And again, never didn't know anything really about it. It was like, oh, that sounds quite interesting. And he gave me the like name of this agency that he was with. It was called Janet Howe in Stoke. I don't know why. I've literally just remembered that. Never given any thought.
That's me and Eileen Bilton.
Yeah.
Warrington.
Yeah. So I was like, fuck it. I'll just have a look at whatever this is.
Yeah.
You know, you'll get 100 quid a day or something just for going and sitting in the background and doing nothing. And so I signed up with this agency, got penciled in to do something on a particular day. I'd actually then, that weekend, was away in Finland fighting and came back and I had stitches and a black eye and my face was smashed in a bit. So I got back home and I thought, all right, I'm not going to be able to go and do this thing. So I called them up and I said, listen, I've got a black eye and stitches. And they were like, yeah, no, you won't be able to do it. Oh. No worries. All right, goodbye. About 15 minutes later, the phone goes, actually, we've got a job for you. Go to Pebble Mill in Birmingham tomorrow. There's a show called Doctors. And that'll be fine.
Be perfect for him.
Yeah. So I went off to Pebble Mill, again, with not having any clue. Turned up. Sat there waiting to go in, shitting myself. And everyone's like, you don't do it. You're literally, you're going to be sat in the background. And then they, in between scenes, come in to go, right, who can we? Oh, you with the eye.
Hello.
Come here. Yeah. And then literally we're supposed to just do a scene where we walk down the stairs. I left and then the actual scene started. And I remember the actress at the time, or as we were doing this, like ad-libbed and just went, next time, be more careful. And I was like, yeah, I will, thank you. Walked out. Then they did the actual scene a few minutes. And then they cut and the director was like, what did he say then? I was like, oh, shit, sorry. He was like, no, just speak up a bit. And I was like, oh, hello.
Hello.
and yeah, that was the first. And obviously that happened and there was that moment. But actually what really happened was being on a set for the first time and seeing behind. You know, when you're watching TV and you see two people there, actually, there's hundreds of people. And something was just like, I guess a little bit like Thai boxing, you know, something just clicked. And this day when I went to do this, something just happened. And I was like, and then carried on doing a bit more extra work. To the point that, you know, they would ring up and go, are you available? I'm like, yep. And then I'd be ringing in work sick the next day going, oh, I don't feel well. I started acting already. I don't feel well. And I'd go off and do whatever it was. And it was all sorts of, you know, great Manchester drama. And again, you know, many jobs, you'd go in the morning, do a scene in the morning. They're like, right, we only need two people to stay and everyone just wants to leave. And
yeah.
Right, I'll take my 100 quid, 60 quid, whatever it was. And I was always like, oh, I'll stay because I was just kind of having it, just learning, and occasionally would just get asked, oh, just say this, just say that.
The drama school was already starting, Warren.
It was starting, yeah. And then I remember doing, what did I do? No way, this is going to come. I love them. Yeah. I did a thing in Blackpool.
Did you?
And I think it was a TV show about, you know, they do them Neighbours from Hell, and it was Tourists from Hell.
Oh, yeah, they'll be in Blackpool.
And there was a story about some people that stayed at a B&B and beat up the owner of the B&B.
Oh, God, yeah.
So we went to do this, like, recreation, and it was, like, quite a bit of ad-libbing and just, oh, just do this. And then I remember the producer, director who was doing this recreation was like, what do you do? And I said, oh, you know, I'm a Thai boxer, but I'm actually, by this point now, I'm sort of starting to think that maybe I want to have a go. And she was like, yeah, well, you know, you need to go to drama school. You need to, you know, get a contemporary piece, get a classical piece. And what happened? I guess you were here to talk about the whole, because I've got like reams on this.
Oh, yeah.
So ended up, doing more and more extra work and just getting, oh, just say this, just say that. Then we started, there was an acting class in Manchester. So I went to this acting class and it was in the same building as Beverly Keogh and David Shaw.
Yeah, up at Ardwick.
I think it was even before it was at Ardwick. It was on, was it Princess Street?
First? Oh, yeah, all right, yeah.
So we started there. Then they moved to Ardwick.
So they were right in town?
Yeah. 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 And it was attached to an agency and we'd go to this acting class. But it also meant that occasionally the you know, David or Beverly would see people. I remember one particular day, wasn't going to go. And you're like, oh, I'll just go. And then as I was leaving, David Shaw being like, get that lad back here. It's like, what are you doing tomorrow? Come for this audition. And that was for Shameless. And,
right.
And it kind of snowballed from there.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Let's just start with Shameless, but how was that first audition for that? How did you feel about going in? Were you able? Do you know how you were walking into the ring? Even if whatever fight, first fight, second fight, you were able to ground yourself and keep everything calm. Are we there when there's a camera in front of you for the first time and they're asking you to read these lines?
Do you know what? Because this was like the first thing I'd ever auditioned for, I probably didn't even, and you don't understand. And obviously he's going, you look like a Scally. We've come into, you know, you're auditioning to play a Scally. So I'm essentially playing myself, which you do for, or certainly for the most part of the early work, it's like, right, you're a scroat, you're going to play loads of scroats for a bit. So I don't think, and also I didn't understand the business at this point, you know, so there was no kind of pressure. I think it's kind of further down the line when you do start working,
right,
you're like, oh, actually then what this means, or, you know, especially when you've gone, right, I'm going to give up this to try and pursue that.
Once you're all in, The stakes become very high, don't they?
Yeah. But I think it's just, yeah, that was that. And then I think it's just knowing that you're, I don't know, doing things that you on a path, this is, I'm going to get wanky now, but kind of getting to a point where you're like, I think that I'm supposed to be doing this.
Yeah.
Oh, the wankometer's just...
No, it hasn't.
Even to the point, and this is like a long, convoluted story, but there was a particular bit of extra work that I did. And there was a show called The Second Coming with Christopher Eccleston.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a particular scene that he performed a miracle at Man City's old stadium. So there was 2 days. We did like a night and then a day, and then over these 2 days, so they could turn it from night to day in the thing. So there's hundreds and hundreds of extras. And so by this point, I've been doing extra work and I've just started this acting class. And, loads of extras want to get into it. Loads are just happy just going up, doing their little bit. And you know, that's what it is. I remember chatting to a lad there throughout these on the first day. And he's like, yeah, I'm going off to drama school. And I'm like, yeah, I'm now starting to think that I might want to have a go at this.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, said the same thing that I'd heard. Yep, you need to go to drama school. You need to get your classical. You need to get your contemporary piece. I'm like, okay. Anyway, on the second day, again, hundreds of extras. So you're not bumping into the same people. And I bumped into this lad again. And he says, oh, mate, here you go. He said, here's the book that I use. And it was Coriolanus.
Right.
And he said, this is what I use for my classical pieces. And you can have it because now I'm going to drama school. I was like, oh, mate, thank you very much. Put it into a bag, never, ever looked at it. Kind of then more extra work carried on. Then the acting classes, then Shameless, then auditioned for drama school in Manchester. I didn't get in because I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
And also, let's just pause a minute, because you were given guidance to go to drama school by a few different people at this point. And also, at that time, I think I'm right in saying street casting and things like that, it wasn't really a thing, because I always cite people like Thomas Turgoose, who was just plucked from obscurity for doing that and being paid to go and audition. Things like that weren't around at the time. So the natural progression, the natural way, was to go to drama school, because there wasn't any other outlet, there wasn't another avenue.
I think so, but, you know, even going to this acting class and people like David Shaw and Beverly Keogh who kind of spotted me first of all. That was, I guess, not right off the street because you go into a class.
But no.
There was that. But there was a minute where, and again, this time, I timeline jumps around all over the shop, but from this acting class, then we, so I'm going to the acting class and there's a group of people each time in your class and you go for a drink with them afterwards. And there was a girl I quite liked at this class who I ended up then seeing, and she was at Salford University doing performing arts. So I kind of started seeing shows. And then, as I say, didn't get into drama school, auditioned for Salford, got into Salford. So then I went there. And this kind of is a bit all over the shop. So then I go to Salford Uni. I'm at uni for about a year. I nip home for the weekend to see my folks, and I find a box of books in my room. And there was a few some plays that a mate had given me, because there was a lad that I an old mate who was also looking at maybe going to drama school. I've just had another. God, this therapy is wonderful.
It's good, isn't it? And it's free.
There was a minute where, and I was still fighting, and he used to come and watch my fights, and he'd auditioned for drama school, hadn't heard anything, and I remember ringing him up one day and pretending to be from the drama school.
Oh, Warren.
I know. I've not thought about this for years. And I remember ringing him going, putting on whatever, acting again, going, it's from such and such, from wherever, drama school. And just wondering if you could come back in this Saturday. And he was like, yeah, no problem. Yeah, brilliant. Oh. And I was like, you're absolutely sure you could make it on Saturday? You've got nothing else planned? And he's like, no, absolutely. I come. And he was like, I knew I was fighting on this particular day. You're definitely sure you're not going to see any of your friends Thai boxing or anything? And he's like, what? And then he realised, oh, you bastard. Anyway, he'd sacked that off, and at one point he'd give me a load of plays. So I found this box and I'm like, right, well, now living in Manchester, I should probably take these with me. And I also found Coriolanus, this book that...
Oh, that he'd given you at
the other guy.
Yeah.
Like I say, the timeline's all over the shot. I'd never, ever looked at it. And I opened up this book and starts flicking through it, and I get to the middle and there's a photograph in the middle of the lad who was doing the extra work, who was going off to, I think it was East 15 or wherever he was going. And I'm like, obviously, you know, when you lend something to someone, you go, oh, there's that. Oh, I'll just take that out and put it in your pocket. And he never did that. He just gave me this book. He didn't realise. I carried on flicking through the book. And in the back of the book, there was a handwritten letter, and I started reading this letter and I'm like, no way. And I recognised the handwriting, and it was like, dear to this lad, it's been great working with you at such and such theatre workshop, da, 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 lots of love. And I was like, no fucking way. And I knew before it got to the end, it was a handwritten letter from the girl that I was seeing from the acting class. So to put it weirdly in perspective, I had in my possession a letter from someone that I hadn't met yet, that I would then end up meeting at an acting class.
No.
And then start going out with. I mean, the story would be amazing if it was like, and that's how I met your mother. But it was actually like coming to an end at this point. But the picture wasn't him and her, but it was him. Like going back to uni and saying, do you know this person? And she was like, yeah, I used to be at this theatre workshop with him years ago. And I'm like, and I know the answer to this, but that's your handwriting, isn't it? And she'd like written this letter just saying, oh, good luck with everything.
Wow.
So just like weird things that kind of kept happening that you go, oh, that's weird.
They're all, you know, little signs.
Aside from the fact, you know, you're making a decision going, I love this, and this is what I want to do, and this is what I wanted to pursue. And I guess the long spin-off from I don't know what the original question was, yeah, then having spent 10 years giving everything to Thai boxing, and also knowing, you know, I didn't do it as it wasn't a career financially, but, you know, I got to travel the world. I've achieved a couple of things. But I also always knew I needed to get into, you needed to get a career, or, you know, just find something else. I knew it wasn't going to last forever. So then when I started having this idea, I knew it wasn't going to be, you can't just decide you want to do it and then it happens. It was like I was very aware of you know what I had to put in Thai boxing to get to where I got to.
Yeah.
So if I was going to give this a shot, and
you're all in,
you've got to go all in. You can't just half-ass do it. And you know, I knew it was not going to be easy, and it wasn't guaranteed. But I wanted to give it my best shot. So at least if it didn't work out, you go, all right, well, I tried, but it didn't work out.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, not having a shot and not giving it a shot and not getting it anywhere. So I remember, going into see the boss of, I was working at a company while I was Thai boxing, and it was like the MD used to come to the gym. And so he was pretty cool because he would let me come in late if I was training in the morning, then I'd go to work, and then he'd, you know, sponsor me and stuff. I remember going into his office one day and saying, like, listen, I'm leaving. I want to be an actor. And he was really great about it. Didn't, because I remember telling my mum and dad for the first time, and that was like, that didn't go down well. Just because they didn't have a clue. They're just like, what? And it was almost like, what, you're going to stop getting your head punched in to go and try and do this?
Why would you do that?
And he was like, all right, great, yeah. And, you know, he'd been supportive of the Thai boxing. And then, again, in a weird kind of full circle moment a few years ago, I was in LA, and this MD has since gone off and lives in America working for another company over there. And we stayed in touch a little tiny bit.
Yeah.
And I was in LA, and he said, oh, I'll come and see you. And he came with his son. I remember when we were at work, he had twins, and I remember them being babies, because all children are babies at some point, Warren, you idiot. But he turned up with his son, who was like 19, 20.
Oh my God.
And just having a bit of a catch up, and he said, yeah, I remember that day. And he said, I actually tell this story a lot, like when he's doing his work stuff, that I remember you coming in and saying, I'm going to leave because this is what I want to try and do.
Yeah. That's extraordinary. That's so lovely.
Yeah, that was a lovely moment. And it's just, I guess, just blagging it, I think.
Well, I think to a greater or less extent.
I need to stop that. Often you talk about it, and I know it was accidental that I got into it, but from the minute that I went, right, this is what I want to do, then you do absolutely everything you can on whatever route and with whatever you've got to try and get to.
We spoke about control before, or lack thereof. Now, how did you feel when you're in well-loved show, very popular show, you love going to work and you love the character, but then you're told that character isn't going to be in it anymore?
We're talking about Luther.
We are talking about Luther. Because apart from us both being in Warrington, even me for a certain amount of time, that's another connection that we have, that we're both told that it's your time's over.
How many times have you been killed off?
A couple, but I'm talking about once.
Only a couple?
Only a couple.
I think I've racked a few up now.
Do you know what? Most. I would say I've been killed off most.
I want to get a death reel, not a show reel, because I think I've got a good few minutes worth of material of death reels.
Yeah, they tend to go for the head with me quite a lot.
I've been shot. I've been eaten by zombies.
You have been eaten by zombies.
Impaled on a spike. Died of a disease and casualty that you didn't see, but he was going in. Luther. How was that come about? I remember getting a phone call one day. That was the first job after occupation. To the point, I actually remember having just watched The Wire when I first got that job, and I actually had The Wire as my ringtone.
You didn't.
I had The Wire as my ringtone. When you walk in the garden? And one of the first calls that I got with that ringtone was my agent going, yeah, you've got the part of Luther. So I was like, amazing, better change that ringtone.
Yeah, quick.
Anyway, then I did three seasons of that, and it was amazing.
Because you loved that job, didn't you?
Yeah.
And it's different when you killed off in a film or a one-off.
Spoiler alert for anyone who's not watched Luther.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. It's all on BBC iPlayer. Yeah. Not sponsored by BBC iPlayer. But when you feel part of a group, of a family.
Yeah.
And you've been together for 3 years and then that's it.
Yeah. Well, he rang me one day and he was like, oh, mate, and he was like, I was like, what is it like? Just come out. He says,
Did you not have any?
No clue.
No.
But this was like, just as we were about to go back for the third season. And he was like, listen, okay, I'm just going to come out of it. And he was like, yeah, they want to kill you off. How do you feel? Like, if you don't want to, I can stop it. And da-da-da. And I was like, oh, and I guess at that time it was a shock. And then you start going, have I done something wrong? Oh, and,
of course, that's the other part of our brain as actors.
Yeah.
Oh, what have I said? Have I upset? I didn't mean it like that. They've taken it the wrong way. Or I'm my big stupid mouth. I've done something wrong.
But also it's never that.
No.
And we chatted and I chatted with Idris about it. And obviously his character was killed off in The Wire, and that's like, I remember watching The Wire
again, season 3,
yeah, and going, well, that's like a kind of a moment that people still talk about.
Absolutely.
And also at this point we thought that this was the last series anyway, and so you're like, all right, you might as well go out with a bang and have it as a moment. So I'm like, kind of made, well, listen, you don't have to make peace. If you're told that's what's happening.
Yeah.
All right, brilliant.
And 9 times out of 10, I would say, it's for the script. It's for the story.
Absolutely.
It's less less about you as a character. Certainly nothing to do with you as an actor. And you just have to put the trust in the writer.
Absolutely. And, you know, the writer, Neil Cross, when I'd spoken to him, he's like, listen, this is just what we want to do. And in drama, in television, in storytelling, hopefully by this point the audience had,
they're invested.
Yeah, they're invested and they love this character.
It's great that they're having something taken away from them. That's
absolutely
drama.
So that, you know, that, and that was a massive, massive moment. It was only after the fact that then they went, oh, actually, no, we are going to do some more. shit, you're dead.
Yeah.
But that's still, you know, it's, when was that? I think 2015. Justin Ripley was killed off in that. But that's still something that, you know, I'll get messages today or you see people like, oh, I cried when Ripley was killed. So it's like, well, brilliant. You want to be part of those massive moments.
Yeah. And I think that massive moment and, you know, certainly my massive moment will be there until we're in the ground, you know. It was one of those things that it keeps coming
back. Absolutely.
And it's actually you to be thankful for it.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely. I remember we went to the Luther movie premiere.
Yeah.
And even the film was being spoken about from when we did like season 1.
Right.
And I remember very shortly after the season 3, when it was still being talked about, and Neil Cross saying, no, we're going to do a prequel, so you're still going to be in the film. So it was like, all right, brilliant. And then, you know, literally, when did this come out? Was it this year? Yeah, I think it was this year. So you're like, it's a bit too, it's not going to be a prequel. I wasn't in the film. But Neil Cross was there, and it was great to see him. I've not seen him for a few years. And we were chatting to him, and he's like, oh, man, my biggest regret still is killing him off. And he's like, well, that's lovely to hear.
But yeah.
As I say, just to be, you know, that particular job and the fans of that show who still talk about that as a moment, you're like, well, I'd rather be
part of,
you know, served that bit of the story to have that reaction.
And, yeah.
You know, I've died in things since, and I hopefully will die in many things more to come.
Warren, there's a few things that I always do on this podcast, and I've just got to go over here and get my readers because I'm 47 years old.
Wait there. So we always ask these questions, sometimes at the beginning, sometimes at the end. So I'd like to ask them you now. And you can interpret these any way you like. Sometimes I might be asking 20-year-old Warren, I might be asking Warren.
Okay? I can play 35!
Warren, answer young or old Warren, it doesn't matter. A good film or a good book?
Good film.
Saturday.
Do I have to tell you whether that's old Warren?
Tell me who is that. Who's answering
that's
that?
Both.
Present Warren.
Good film.
Present Warren, Saturday night or Sunday morning?
Ooh. What about... even just a few years ago, Warren would have probably definitely been Saturday night. But now I quite enjoy, yeah, Sunday morning.
Yeah. What about city shopping or a country stroll?
I mean, can I have? I like a little bit of city shopping, but country stroll.
Yeah.
Bit of fresh air, bit of nature.
We're at the theatre, Warren, not we. You are at the theatre. It's not going to plan.
Does my agent know I'm at the theatre?
Would you walk out at the interval or sit through it?
I was going to say I'll sit through it, but actually I've walked out. But that was, I walked out of a Hungarian musical. I walked out of Billy Elliot in Hungarian.
Okay.
And Billy Elliot was my favourite musical and I'd seen it a few times over here.
It must have been terrible.
But it was just, well, it just wasn't what we get in the West End. It was in Hungarian with subtitles. Subtitles on the stage.
I think it is, dear.
We left in the interval. But ordinarily, I think if I was...
So you'd sit it out?
In town, I'd sit it out, yeah.
Even with, especially when you got friends in, that can be very awkward.
I've never... Luckily, I've been to see mates and stuff, including yourself, and it was brilliant, so I didn't have to walk out. But I've seen... Actually, we went with a group once to watch someone, and I won't say who, and another person, director, was with us, and he thought it was awful and went left. And then we all met up afterwards, and he came back and was like, oh, yeah, great, great, well in. And I hadn't seen the second half of it.
Did you talk about the set?
That's what you do. Oh, the set was amazing.
Less ambition or more present, Warren?
I have been and am very ambitious, but it's like it's to a point of going, well, what do you need? What do you need to be happy to be able to go to work and love your job and pay your bills? That's kind of all you need, isn't it? So many people don't like going to work.
So many people don't like going to work. Like, I got up the other morning at 6 to get out. We were both leaving the house and my partner said, you know, this is what normal people have to do every day. And I went, well, yeah, but wait a minute. I'm up sometimes at 5 o'clock in the morning to go to work.
You can't win those battles, can you?
No. Positive or negative?
Positive.
Always?
Yeah, trying my best.
True or false, offence is taken, never given.
Ooh, I think it's taken, isn't it?
There's nothing funnier than the fool who thinks he's clever.
Hang on a minute. What's the question?
It's just a quote.
You're just giving me quotes now.
I'm just giving you quotes now. I think it's quite a nice quote. There's nothing funnier than the fool who thinks he's clever.
What, are you calling me the fool who thinks
he's not clever? I'm not saying that, mate. Never be that rude.
There's a lot to unpack there.
Maybe we'll save it for another podcast. Warren Brown, what an absolute joy.
Mate, thank you so much. And I'm glad we got to jump on, albeit 5 years late, but before it finished. Because honestly, driving up and down the country to work or going back up to see folk, this has been one of my staple podcasts. And to listen to people that I've worked with or, you know, hugely respect in the industry and listen to their stories. And then also listen to people who I haven't met and I don't know and listen to their stories. And then I guess I've got the fear that this will be out there and people will be like, oh, what's that? But ultimately, you know, you can only tell your story and it's not going to be for everyone. And
This will be, and it's brilliant. All the love. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you, mate.
And another episode is done. What did I tell you? Great, great company. I love Warren to bits. And there's loads of stuff there that I didn't know about, which is always the way when you're talking to a friend. It's like, you know, usually there's a few of us out, but it's never just like one-on-one like that. So I really appreciate his time. And I'm quite concerned that you may think there's terrible things going on. Do you hear this? I'm sat on a leather chair. It's not ideal for recording, just in case you heard something in the intro there. It was just a leather chair, I promise you. I haven't let you down, have I? No, exactly. So
Next week, we are going with two episodes. I've already recorded one of them. I'm not going to tell you who it is, but you're going to love it. And I think it may jump straight into one of the all-time top favourite episodes. It's with a comedian. That's all I'm going to say. And earlier in the week, you'll hear from an incredible writer that I'm really interested in talking to. I'm going to meet her next week. So next week, double your two-shot pod just to get you in that Christmas spirit. They're not Christmassy episodes. But if you're out shopping or you're just feeling, maybe you're feeling a bit blue, maybe you need double two-shot in a week. That's good, isn't it? Let's do that. So I'm going to see you next week for two episodes. Yeah? Yeah. Until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. Oh, forgot to tell you. So last week at the start of Neil Forsyth's episode, do you remember I was talking about the incredible, legendary comedian, Mr. Barry Cryer? And I read a joke from his book that his son, Bob Cryer, wrote. After I got back from my 7.5 hour car journey today, I was just catching up on social media and responding to some people to do with the podcast. And I got a lovely message from Bob. And I think he was made up. So thank you, Bob Cryer, for allowing me to tell that brilliant joke. The book is fantastic. So I'm really pleased that he enjoyed the episode with Neil Forsyth. Yeah, that was all I had to tell you. Right, I'm going to go and have my dinner. So until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. Only a few more to go. We'll see you for two next week. Take care. That was the leather seat again, promise. The Two Shot Podcast was presented by me, Craig Parkinson. Recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. The remix of our theme tune is by Stolen Valor. Cheers.